You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Christophe Lemoine, the French Consul General here in Los Angeles, and it's my great, great pleasure to be with you tonight at the Public Downtown Library to welcome a French author, a French writer, a very stunning French writer. But before that, I would like to thank Ken Breaker and the whole team of the Public Library who made that event possible tonight. It's a would like to thank them for their for this achievement. It's a it's absolutely wonderful, and we're deeply honored to welcome tonight in Los Angeles Edouard Louis, one of a young but very promising and stunning French author. As you might know, one of our missions as the French consulate here in the United States and French Cultural Services, and our role is to invite and promote French fiction and non-fiction authors. And over the past few years, we were fortunate to have brilliant authors touring the United States, and some of them went here at the Downtown Public Library, such as Leila Slimani in April, Emmanuel Carrère, or lately, Negard Javadi, whose book Disoriental was just shortlisted in the translated book section of the National Book Awards. But this author on tour program began much earlier. It's something that the French Cultural Service have been doing for quite a long time. And it started actually at the end of World War II, when the French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss decided to create that program when he was a cultural attaché in New York. And the idea was clearly to promote the French authors in the United States and to promote major French writers in the United States and make them discover to American readers. And since the beginning, it has been a great success, and I have to admit that it's been a great success thanks to the American readers and thanks to American institutions who believed in that program. And that program brought you, dear American Francophiles, great names of literature throughout the years, such as Nathalie Sarraute or Michel Butor, to name few. And Edouard Louis is in fact one of our major contemporary authors. He sold more than 300,000 copies of The End of Eddie. It was his first book. And most recently, he published, it's a book which is also translated in English, The History of Violence. And through those two books that were translated in English, there's the third one that will come after, he managed to gather a great number of readers around the world. And among each writers of Edouard Louis, me included, each of them has been deeply moved by the clever blend of emotion and theory that he uses to relate autobiographical elements. And in fact, all the art of the literature of Edouard Louis is this art of autofiction at which he's a master in central. In recent English and non-English fiction, he's a central writer as far as autofiction is concerned. And especially, I would say, among queer writers, from Proust to Edmund White. So this may be another reason why his work is so much appreciated here in the United States. And in front of him, there will be another great great poet, an American poet, who made us the honor to answer positively to that invitation to have a discussion with Edouard Louis. And this great poet is an Angeleno, is Stephen Rains, who has been awarded the City Poet of West Hollywood from 2014 to 2016, and edited an opus that is called My Life is Poetry, which featured the groundbreaking autobiographical poetry workshop for LGBT seniors. And Stephen has also taught writing workshops around the country to LGBT youth and people living with HIV. He has recently received the LA County Department of Cultural Affairs Artist in Residency a grant that was given 14 times. So I think those Edouard Louis and Stephen Rings will bring us tonight a very fruitful and a very interesting discussions around all those subjects that have been quoted. And just before giving them the floor, I would like to thank again the Downtown Public Library, Steve Ken Bricker again, and also Louise Steinman that was at the beginning of this project, and that I would like to thank very warmly tonight. So I leave them. Yes. So I will give them the floor now, and again, I would like to thank the library for making this conversation possible, and I just wish you a very, very good evening and very interesting evening with Edouard Louis and Stephen Rings. Thank you very much.
Wow, I want to thank everyone for coming out tonight, and it's an honor to sit here with Edouard and talk about his book. And I want to thank, first of all, the French Consulate, the Library Foundation, and especially Louise Steinem and Maureen Moore, who who conceptualized tonight's event and worked hard in order to make this happen. And so on a personal note, I want to say that I chose to continue to participate in tonight's evening to honor Louise's vision for this evening and also generally the vision of the Aloud series, which she founded 30 years ago. So. So I thought what would be a great way to start off tonight's program is to have you read a passage from your book.
Yeah. Hello. Good evening. I don't really like readings, so I'm just going to read the first page of the first novel, since we are mostly discussing the second one tonight. I thought it would be boring to read the things we are going to talk about, so it's better just to read about the other book called The End of Eddie. I will do my best. From my childhood, I have no happy memories. I don't mean to say that I never, in all those years, felt any happiness or joy. But suffering is all-consuming. It somehow gets rid of anything that doesn't fit into its system. Two boys appeared in the hallway, the first tall, with red hair, and the second short, with a hunchback. The tall red hair, spat in my face. "How do you like that, punk?" The gob of spit dripped slowly down my cheek, thick and yellow, like the noisy mucus that obstructs the throat of old people or people who are ill, with a strong, sickening smell to it. Shrill, strident laughter from the two boys. "Look, right in his face, the little pussy." It is dripping from my eye right towards my lips, ready to enter my mouth. I don't dare wipe it off. I could. I'd only have to lift my sleeve. It would even take a second, a tiny movement, to prevent the spit from coming into contact with my lips, but I do nothing for fear of offending them, for fear of making them more agitated than they already are. That's it.
Thank you. And you follow that up with talking about not reporting the bullying and that violence that was inflicted upon you, mm-hmm. Because there was so much shame about being the recipient of that kind of violence. And you've also stated that shame is a feeling that forges my life as a writer.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. I mean, I am a son of shame, you know. I was born in shame and with shame, and it's what constituted me. And first I was ashamed of what I was, because society was giving me no choice but to be ashamed. You know, like society was telling me, you have to be ashamed of what you are because you are gay, because you are not normal, because you are not like the other people. But even more than that, as you were talking about, I was not only ashamed of what I was, but I was also deeply ashamed of suffering, you know. I didn't want people to know that I was suffering because, you know, I don't know, it was as if it was revealing something about my, I don't know, weakness or a problem about me. Mm-hmm. So I describe in The End of Eddie and in History of Violence how I tried to make believe other people, like if they thought that I was not normal, I tried to make them believe that they were the only one on earth to think that. I didn't want them to realize that it was a collective thing, you know. So maybe they would think that they were wrong if they thought that they were the only ones to think this way about me. And so, yeah, I mean, during all my childhood, these two guys bullied me in school, spat on me, called me faggot, beat me, and I was the person who would protect them. Because I couldn't go and talk to a person and say, I suffer. That was the most difficult things for me to do. And I think that it occurs in a lot of situations. You know, like in my books, I also talk about poverty, about growing up in a very poor family in the north of France. And when I published my books, my mother was very angry, and she told me, "Why do you say we are poor?" You know, for her, like I talked about racism and homophobia and misogynia and everything. And for her, to be poor was the worst thing, because exactly like me, as a gay person, she was ashamed of being poor, you know, because like the dominant ruling classes, the government makes her believe that if she's poor, it's because of her, it's her fault, it's because of a problem with her. And so it becomes a major political issue, because you think like, how can we change the world if the people who suffer are ashamed of suffering, if they don't want to say it, you know? And it's very difficult. And plus in the public discourse, you have always people who tell you to shut up, you know? For example, what we call victimization. I don't know if you hear it a lot in the United States, but a lot of people...
Quite a bit of it, yes.
Yeah. Unfortunately, everywhere in the world I talk about it, I hear the same answer. It happens everywhere, in Korea or Japan or France or Russia or Kosovo, anywhere. And what does it mean, you know? It means there are too many people saying I am a victim. There are too many people saying I suffer. For me, like, this is the opposite. The problem is the opposite. The first question that we should ask ourselves is, considering how much people suffer from poverty, from racism, from masculine domination, from transphobia, from homophobia, from so many things, why is it so rare to have someone saying, I suffer, I am a victim, you know? And so like this word victimization makes me vomit so much. It makes me sick. It kills me. I hate it. And there are so many ways of trying to shut down people, to make them just shut. And so I was like that as a child. I didn't want to speak out. What people would have told me, stop being a victim, stop acting like a victim. I didn't want that, so I preferred to just say nothing.
Yeah, and you also had that internalized shutting it down. You talk in The End of Eddie of, even in the bullying scene, of not crying, making a point of not crying. And then in your second book, The History of Violence, there's a scene where you're at the doctor and they're asking a lot of invasive questions, and you're kind of counting down, you know, to the end of the appointment, so you do not cry in front of this doctor.
Yeah, I mean, it was for slightly different reasons. In the first book, it was because this guy were bullying me, and they were bullying me because I was gay, because I was not masculine enough. So I was so scared that if I was crying, it would make them worse. It would make them super angry. So I was trying to hide that. And I was somehow smiling when they were bullying me a lot. Because, not because it was funny, but because I wanted to convince them that everything was just a joke, you know? Mm-hmm. As if like my smile had a kind of performative power, you know, like if I smile, they will end up believing that I'm not the faggot. I'm not the guy they are talking about, you know. And this is something you very often see for people who serve. Like recently, I met Toni Morrison, and it was an absolute wonderful moment. And we were at her place and everything. And the things that surprised me the most when I met her was to see how much she laughs. Like, she laughs all the time, talking about even about the worst thing, even talking about the current governments in the US and everything. Like, she was upset, but she was always laughing while talking about it. And so I asked her, I said, like, is it linked to like this smile, is it linked to a precarious life, to the fact of having a precarious body? It is something that you try to, a kind of thing that you build to protect yourself, you know? And I see that most of the time with people who are precarious because of what they are, because of the ways they are being perceived by others, not necessarily what they are. And that's why. And I think even with the doctors in History of Violence in the second book, I was aware of like making them believe that they couldn't enter my body, you know, like if I was crying, it would have been like opening a door, and I didn't want that. I prefer to pretend, you know, and cry when I want to cry with the people I choose, you know. Yeah.
So it was almost like choosing who you share your vulnerability with.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because talking doesn't mean anything as such. Like, the question is like, who are you talking about? Who are you talking to? What are you talking about? Who are you talking to? And sometimes talking means screaming. Sometimes talking means crying. Sometimes speaking means being silent. Like, talking can mean so many different things. And that was a very big issue with History of Violence, you know, because, so basically the book, the core of the book is a sexual and physical assault that I endured in Paris in 2012 from a guy I met in the street that I had sex with and that I loved, and suddenly he became crazy in the middle of the night and assaulted me and tried to kill me. And so the book is an attempt to understand what happened. And one of the very strange things is that for me it was a when I went to the police to say it, because he really tried to kill me, so it was not a small thing. When I went to see the police, forced by my friends, because I didn't want to do it, I didn't want to report, not because I didn't want to report as such, but because I didn't want this history to become something about the future. I didn't want to think I will have to talk about it again and again. I just wanted it to
and
become
here we
the
are.
Past.
Yeah,
exactly.
All right.
But precisely, that's exactly related to what you were saying before. Because the thing is that I didn't want to see the police again. I didn't want to see the doctors again. I didn't want to talk about that story again and again and again to the judge, to my lawyer, to the police, to people who wouldn't believe me, to people who would think that it was a little bit my fault, or to people who were racist, so were saying, yeah. Oh, this guy is because he's not white that he assaulted you. So they were using my story in order to be racist, which was, for me, as traumatic as insulting me. And I didn't want that, but and I often say that, and people say, but why did you write a book about it? But because when I write a book, I choose my audience, you know? I choose the way I tell the story. I choose the way I write it, you know? And the people who will come to listen to me, they will have choose it, and they are probably people that have a common ground with me, something to share with me, because they are queer, because they are lefty, because they are interested in literature. But I had nothing in common with the police or the doctor. We were even incompatible on so many levels, because they didn't understand what happened, because they were so straight, for example. They didn't, like, they told me, why did you invite a guy to come to your place in the street? I said, like, every gay person do it, you know? Because for so many years, we didn't have bars, we didn't have restaurants, we didn't have places. It was dangerous to meet someone in a place, so we had to meet in the street, and it's a story that is being perpetuated. And, you know, I was at the police, and I was giving a class about history of homosexuality. So it's not what I wanted, you know?
Yeah.
And that plus the racism, plus so many things. You know, I remember when I told them the story, and then they printed it out, they printed the report out. I read, and it was not my history at all, you know, because it was framed with the language, it was framed with the straight language, with the white language, with the racist language, with the police, with the state language, and it was not my story at all. And so talking in writing the book and talking to them, it was as if it was the two most different things in the world, you know? It was talking and talking, or speaking and speaking. I have trouble understanding the difference. It was the same story, but depending on who I was talking to, it was one of them destroyed me and one of them saved me, you know, yeah. Really.
What's interesting about talking about your story is that I don't recall any text from that police report entering the book, right? I don't recall any of that. But you do have the narrative of your sister in a way that she's kind of telling this story, mm-hmm. in a way. How did you choose that?
I mean, I chose that because I thought that it was really relevant considering the story. Because what I experienced precisely after the sexual assault, it was that as soon as I would talk about my story, it was not my story anymore. You know, mm-hmm. It belonged to the police. It belonged, and everyone was framing my story. You know, my sister in a different way. The police was framing it in a way that I didn't like. They were using it to do things that I didn't want. You know, because for example, it's the core of the book, and it's one of the paradoxes that I try to point out. The fact that I knew it was important to report, and I think it's important to report, that it's super important to report, and all my books are kind of reports in a way. But at the same time, I was opposed to repression and punishment, so I didn't want that guy to go to jail. I didn't want that guy to be punished. Because I personally don't think that it's the way of fixing things. You don't fight violence with violence. You don't fight violence by putting a body into a cage. That's against my way of thinking. But if you say that to the police doesn't care, you know? Yeah. They have something and they say, your story doesn't belong to you anymore. This is one of the core sentences of the book when I say to the police, so if, because they told me, okay, we are going to put this bastard 15 years in jail. And I say, this is not what I want. And I don't want you to use my story to do it. And they tell, but your story doesn't belong to you anymore. It belongs to the states. So your body doesn't belong to you anymore, you know? And for me, it was exactly like the assault from this guy. They were taking my body from me one more time. And that's what I address in the book. And it's something that completely disappeared today. But at some point, for example, in France, there was a group around Simone de Beauvoir, a group of feminist women, and the group was called the Groupe de Libération des Femmes. And there were women who were helping other women to report, supporting them, helping them, giving them advice, protecting them, talking to them, living with them to help them during the process. And then when there was the trial, these women around Simone de Beauvoir, they would go to the court and they would protest against punishment. You know? So they say there is something to do. We don't say you assault and it's okay. Mm-hmm. It's the opposite of that. But they say we don't meet violence with violence. We won't fix violence with punishment. And it's a tradition that today almost completely disappeared. Only maybe Angela Davis is one of the very, very rare feminists who is against punishment. But for me, what I wanted to do through History of Violence was to reactivate this tradition of thinking and this tradition of like fighting violence on every side. You know, it's important for me.
And also in terms of your story, things being out of your control. So I had read that the DNA evidence collected from your assault was linked back to someone who was recently charged with a petty crime. Could you talk about that? So the character of Retta, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, there is no fictions in my book. I am not really interested in writing fiction. I love reading it, but I don't want to write it. And so in the reality... things happen, and yes, they found that guy who assaulted other. But precisely one of the things I knew, for example, is that guy, before assaulting me, he went to jail. He was only 30 and he already went to jail for a long time. But most of the time for pretty small crimes, like robberies or drugs or this kind of stuff. And it's after going to jail that he tried to kill me, you know? So I could say in a way that mm-hmm. the jail system and the obsession of people for punishment and repression put my body in danger. and the prison system almost killed me, you know. It's what happened in France, for example, with the terrorist attack in Paris. A lot of the people that committed the terrorist attack, most of them had the same trajectory in their life. They went to jail because of small things, because of robberies, because of drugs, and after going to jail, they became super violent. And they killed people in the Bataclan, and they killed people. And so how can we face that and not question the justice system and not question the prison system, you know? As if the urge of punishing was beyond everything else, you know? And I experienced it, I talk about it in History of Violence, even my friends, even my closest friends mm-hmm. were telling me, and I understand they wanted to protect me because they love me as much as I love them, but how can we refuse to think about it, you know? You tell them, but look, these people, they go out of jail, as such it's a violent thing to put a body in a cage, but after they are even more violent, and you want to do that? So you don't care if they will kill other people, as much as you will have punishment, you will be released, you know? There is something, there is a point that needs to be questioned and challenged. And I don't say that I have the solution, you know? My book is not an essay, it's not a philosophical book. I read theory, I work with theory, but it's just, I talk about the way how, like, in what happened to me and what I see around me, I know that these kind of things didn't work, and I think we can invent much like other ways of dealing with violence, and I think in the Me Too system, in the Me Too movement, it's very important to ask this question, particularly in the United States today. How can we think differently, and how can we fix violence with something else than violence? So that guy was found, and then with my lawyer, we tried to find ways of fixing the situation without punishment. With troubles for him, but not punishment. And I don't say it's easy. I don't pretend it's easy, but it's something we shouldn't be lazy about. We have to push ourselves to see this reality, because in a way everyone knows it. Like everyone in this room knows that people become super violent in jail, that it creates violence in society and everything. We all know that. But very rarely we use it in order to challenge what is going on around us.
Yeah. And is it true that he actually tried to press charges against you for the likeness of him in your book?
No.
That's not true.
This is gossips from right-wing journalists who hate me because I'm against punishment, and it's for them such a big thing. No, it was something from the lawyer about my book. It was something completely. It was completely rewritten in the right wing media. Yeah. So it was not true.
Okay. Well, that was a fascinating turn. And so, you know, when talking about going to the police, you make a statement of you didn't know how much you would kind of hate yourself for doing that, and kind of disclosing to the police. Do you wish you would have done things differently?
I don't know, because precisely because of the system we are living in, I am living in, it's too paradoxical, because I think it's a problem not to press charge. So I don't say I should have pressed charge, you know, because mm-hmm. we can't let people do this kind of things. We have to fix it. And in another way, we are stuck with this system. One of the great speaker of that issue is the woman who was assaulted by Polanski, you know, by the movie director. She always said, "I want to report. I want to say it. It was important to say it." And she was very brave. She did it. She had to face people saying it's not true and everything. Like it happens all the time. And at the same time, she was saying, "I don't want a trial. I don't want to fix it with punishment and everything." And people didn't care. So people say, you know, like there is. If I can compare something that is incomparable, but that's why a comparison is interesting, isn't it? There is a wonderful that I really advise you to read. There is a wonderful essay from Primo Levi, the writer who was a survivor from the concentration camps from Auschwitz, and his last book is called The Drowned and the Saved. It's a book that was published after he committed suicide, after he killed himself. So it was his last book, and it's a book of essay. And in one of the books, he makes a kind of analysis of the letters he received after publishing his first book, Sequestro Nomo, If It's a Man, his first book about his experience in Auschwitz and his experience in the camps and everything. It was translated to Survival in Auschwitz in English by Primo Levi. And so he reads the letters that he received. And what is incredible is that a lot of the people that didn't go to the camps, they write to Primo Levi, you are not tough enough with the Nazis, you are not hard enough, as if you were trying to understand, as if you were... And like when I read it, it was fascinating because I was thinking, you know, like these people, they didn't experience that, they didn't suffer, and they are lecturing Primo Levi about the way he should deal with the suffering, you know? And it's always a thing that happened in our world that people didn't suffer, lecture people who suffered about the way they should deal with it, you know? And it's exactly what happened in the history of violence, of people telling me, like, you should do that, you should do that, you should do that. I don't say that I was the most rational because I was suffering and everything, but at least what would be a system where the victim has a place to say something, has a place to... That doesn't exist in our countries. That doesn't exist in France. That doesn't exist in the US, not really. Sometime now I'm realizing that I have more powers than I expected with the judge and everything, but not enough, not enough. And some people are smashed by it. I thought I was so... I was part of a small minority, people who didn't want to punish absolutely and who wanted to report once again but didn't want to punish. And I thought when I was publishing History of Violence, it would be very difficult because people won't understand my point. And suddenly I started to travel in Norway, in Asia, in Japan, in Kosovo and everything. And I met so many people, most of the time women, unfortunately, because most of the time it happens to women, who told me I felt exactly the same. And it was so powerful for me to know that I was not alone and that these people, we just never listen to them. We just never hear them, you know? And I want to give these people a voice.
Yeah, there's someone snapping even for you, yeah. it's resonating for people. And in terms of giving people a voice, you've also been doing that with, the community that you grew up in.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because one of the biggest feelings that I had in my childhood is that we were speechless, you know, that no one cared about us. And it was a sentence that my mother would say all the time, like every day. Or my sister, who is the narrator of the History of Violence, would say all the time, like, no one care about us, no one care about us, no one care about us. And it was the kind of, it was the engine for every single behavior, almost, you know. Like my family would vote for the far right, for Marine Le Pen, because they said, no one care about us, she's the only ones who care about us. And all the time, it was an obsession, these feelings that we had, because it was true, in fact, because no one talked about us. And then for me, it was even worse, because so I grew up in this family where all my family stopped school at 14 or 15 years old. Most of my family went to jail, not most, but some people in my family,
grandfather,
my cousin who died there. And so that's why also I have a particular point of view on that issues. And I was the first of my family who would go to high school and would study. And I went to Paris and I started to study philosophy. I don't say that to say that I'm a hero, but just to say that when I arrived in Paris, it was even more striking how absent we were. Like, I started to read books. I started to read literature. I started to go to movies. I started to go to theater. And we were nowhere, you know? We were nowhere. I would never find someone like my sister. I would never find a language. I would never find our way of life. Sometimes I would see a couple of things about the working class, like blue collar and everything, but we were not that. We were less than that. Like, we considered blue collars to be a kind of bourgeois because they had money coming up every month, and we had welfare, and we had prison issues and everything in our families that the people working in factories rarely had. And so yes, I saw all of that. I saw how absent we were, and that's what made me start writing. You know, it was a revenge against culture. I hated culture so much. I hated literature so much, mm-hmm. and that's why I started to write my books, because I wanted to give visibility to my people. You know, and exactly like the people that I admire the most did in the past. You know. I know that Toni Morrison or Zohan Ilerstone wrote because they wanted to give visibility to their people, or that André Gide or Violette Le Duc or Edmund White did the same. And so that's why I started to do it. But for me, it was very important to, you know, to give a visibility and to give a voice and to give a presence, to give a body through the language to the people of my childhood. Was not to do a kind of elegy, or not was not kind of doing a kind of like like saying that they were good. I wanted to be fair. Also, it was not like saying how great they were, because they were not great. Yeah. They were not great. They were not great because they were suffering. You know, and when you suffer, very often you want to make other people suffer. It was Freud called. Principle of perpetuation of violence. When you suffer from violence all the time, every day long, again and again, very often you end up by recreating this violence on other people. Unfortunately, not on the people who make you suffer, but on other people, towards women, towards gay people, towards people of color. And that's what happened in my childhood. It was impossible to be gay. It was impossible to not be white. It was impossible to be a woman. And so I wanted, like, giving a voice to the people, to my people, was not saying that they were fantastic, because it very often happens when rarely people talk about the working class, you know.
Yeah, and I imagine that's because for people to look at the reality, I imagine it makes people feel more comfortable to think like, oh, well, they're poor, but they're so happy, or they're so close-knit, or, you know, they've got that realness together. I don't know what, but, so you're presenting something that's potentially uncomfortable for people.
Yeah. I mean, because like mostly when it comes to poor people, you have two options. So either you have the right-wing approach, the lazy working class, the dangerous working class, the smelly working class, like all these things, mm-hmm. the kind of things Emmanuel Macron thinks about the working class. it's true. And on the other hand, you have a kind of, I don't know, exotic vision of the good working class, the people who know they love to laugh, they have a good life, they suffer, but you know, they are good people, and they don't wear masks, you know, as if wearing a mask was a problem. I mean, I love theater, I think it's beautiful mm-hmm. to try to be something else. And so I wanted to write against these two visions, against these two approach. And for me, it was also a very contemporary way of talking about poverty, you know? Because when you say the great people, who are you talking about, you know? You don't talk about women, you don't talk about LGBT, you don't talk mm-hmm. about different people, you don't talk about disabled people, there are so many people you don't talk about, you know? Yes, they were laughing, but they were laughing about gay and Arabs, you know? So to talk about the poor people, like les classes populaires, we would say in French, and in English, unfortunately, there is a lack of language about that. it's true, to talk about them in a very contemporary, to talk about them and about us, because it is me also, it is where I come from, in a very contemporary way, obviously, like led me. You know, to that, to this way of thinking and talking and elaborating, but it was so against some people's ideology. You know, some people hated me for doing that. You know, mm-hmm. some from like very old-fashioned leftist people. You know, who belonged to the Communist Party in the 60s or 70s. They couldn't accept the vision that I was giving. That I was not saying, he was so good, contrary to the bourgeoisie, the working class is amazing, you know.
And
but most of the time, the people who say that they are not living in the working class, you know. So they love the distance they have, you know. They think they like the object, but they like the distance with the object. They think they like a reality, but they like the distance with the reality. Some things that happened with my name, you know, because I was born Eddie. And contrary to United States, Eddie and Edouard are two completely different names. Mm-hmm. And in terms of social class, they are the most opposite, because Eddie is extremely working class and Edouard is super bourgeois. when I switched from Eddie to Edouard, some of the people in Paris I was studying with, some of the philosophy or sociology students and everything, they would tell me, oh, but Eddie is such a great name, you know? It's so funny. And I would tell them, but you know, if you think it's that fantastic, like the name was always like Charles or Alice or a thing. And if you think it's that fantastic, like go to court and ask to be called Eddie. And of course, no one of them wanted, you know? And so they didn't like my name. They like the distance with the name. And it's something that we have to pay attention to, like in general, like, when people are talking about something, when people are talking about a certain reality, are we sure they are talking about this reality, or are they talking unconsciously about the distance they have with this reality? And I think as we ask this question to ourselves, we understand a lot of things, I think.
Yeah. And when talking about the realities of your life, it's inevitable that, I mean, you're going to be talking about your family. And so you said your mother was displeased and even going to the media
to say the
about
least.
It. Yeah. What about your other family members? And then also your sister, who features so prominently in this latest book. What is that like for them?
Yeah, I mean, first I have to admit that when I was writing, I didn't think about it. Mm. I didn't think about my family at all. I was thinking about queer people. I was thinking about what it is to be queer. I was thinking about people who were bullied at school. And for me, that was my real belonging, more than people that I had just blood in common with, mm-hmm. you know. So I wasn't thinking about them. My belonging was somewhere else. And so, yes, then when I published the books, the first one and the second one, it came out of a surprise, because I thought, oh yes, they are here. And I mean, it's not despising, it's just that I wanted to choose my belonging. I wanted to choose where I belong to and everything. And I was writing about them as a community. I was writing about that as a class, as poor people, but never about like my mama and my papa. You know, it didn't occur to me. And then, yes, the books came out, and my mother was extremely upset. Like, she would go on TV. She told me I was the worst son on earth. She would go to like all this mainstream program on TV to say that she was displeased, to say the least. Again, and then we talked. I talked to her. And that's what popped up. She told me, why do you say we are poor, you know? And with the second book, it went better, because precisely we had the first one before. And yeah. So we talked together and we had a different kind of relationship, and they were okay. They were okay. I even, like, when I published my first book, I wasn't talking to my father at all for years. So I stopped talking to him when I was, I don't remember, maybe 16 or 17. We didn't have any argument. We didn't insult each other. We didn't slap the doors or anything. We just stopped talking, because we had such different lives. We were different people with different bodies. I was studying. He was excluded from school very young. I was reading Toni Morrison. He was sweeping the streets to pick up the garbage from the bourgeoisie. We didn't have the same body anymore. We didn't see the world the same way anymore. So we just couldn't talk together anymore. So we just, like, slowly, you know, took our distance from each other. And And when my and I had a difficult relationship to my father, as you know, when I was a child, because he was ashamed of me because I was gay, and he was telling me all the time, like, why do you do that? Why do you bring shame on our family?
He called you the shame of the family.
Yeah, he told me I was the shame of the family. He was telling me that because of me, everyone was talking about us. Everyone was thinking, oh, this is the family of the fagot. And so he was telling me, why are you like this? Why do you that? Do you do that to make us suffer?
And yet, at the same time, it was your brother who was physically abusing his girlfriend. Is that correct? Is that
yeah? You know, my brother is super violent. My father was never like physically violent. He was extremely violent in the way that he was treating my mother or me. Mm-hmm. But it's a level of complexity for someone like him. When I published a book, my father called me. And he told me that he was proud of me and that he wanted to see me again. And he bought 20 copies of the book, mm-hmm. in which I talk about me as a gay person, in which I talk about the fact that at 9 years old, I was having sex with my cousin in the barn, and that it was wonderful. And it was such a shame for my father. Can you imagine, like, offering a book to a friend in which his son is doing sodomy with his cousin? Like, can you imagine? And it was, and he bought like 20 copies of the book, and he was giving them to his friends and everything. Like, and every time I was on the cover of a magazine or something, he would buy it and make copies of it and put it everywhere on his walls. Like, and it was crazy. It was crazy how differently he reacted. Like, the difference between his reaction and my mother's reaction.
Yeah, and also how differently they're portrayed in the book as well. That his cruelty is very apparent in the book.
Yeah,
and that he doesn't seem to have a sense of shame about it or embarrassment that he's sharing this book openly. His pride of you and your accomplishment is so big.
But in the other way, there is another father in the book, and there is even a chapter called The Other Father, because precisely my father would say that, you know, we have to kill faggots. He would say this kind of things. And one day, when a gay guy in the village was assaulted by a group of rednecks, my father went and said, "You don't touch him, or I kill you. He does what he wants. Don't touch him." Or, for example, my father was extremely racist, was voting for the National Front, and always cursing against what he called strangers, what he called Arabs. Mostly Arabs. This is the French obsession of racist people in France. And like during all my childhood, like I heard so many about it, like so much about it, like against Arabs all the time, every day. No matter the conversation, it always led to that. Always. I promise, you can't imagine how much. And so very, when I was very young, I felt very close from Arabs because I felt like faggots and Arabs have the same destiny. so I remember that when Jean-Marie Le Pen was on the second tour of the election, I cried because I felt that something was wrong. I was maybe 9 years old and I cried because I was so scared. And one day my mother told me, your father, when he was a teenager, his best friend was an Arab, and they were traveling France together. It's the only time in his life that your father traveled, that he went in another village, in another region, and he was with him, and they loved each other. And my mother would say even things that they had sex together, and which I don't know if it was her fantasy or not, but or if it was true. I never dared asking to my father. But he was always many person at a time, even if it's very banal from a racist person to say, oh, I don't like black people, but I like you, or this kind of stupid things. But in a way, my father was always, he was kind of stuck in his in the norms of his milieu. I knew that he was, it doesn't mean that it was not a problem, his violence. Of course, you know, it's not because you give the causes that you say it's okay. But he was always stuck in this body, stuck in this masculinity, stuck in, and this is the subject of my new book that just came out in France, that will come out next year in the US. Yeah, right. It's about him, it's about how trapped he was in his body, I didn't perceive it when I was a child, because when I was a child, I hated him. I hated him so much for who he was. And then it's precisely the distance, it's precisely by living that I understood him, you know? So sometimes it's the further you are from people and the better you understand them. And I understood that. I understood that maybe my father was someone different, and maybe he was also suffering from his own violence, you know? Because, for example, as a man, he never said, I love you to my mother, because to say I love you was considered feminine, effeminate and everything. And so my mother didn't feel love at all. And when he was 45, she left him, and it destroyed him because he was crazy in love with her. It destroyed him forever, like he will never recover from that. And so, you know, it like his own masculine violence of never saying I love you to her, of never considering her enough, destroyed her, but also him, you know, because he lost the person he loved, you know. And so I'm trying to show that in the books, in History of Violence, Eddie, or Who Killed My Father, which is the new book. I try to show how we can be as much a victim of the violence we receive as of the violence that we perpetuate, you know. I think it's true.
Thanks. We have some time for some audience questions. And so when you entered, you were given a card, or maybe you had an opportunity to pick up a card to write down a question. And so a basket is going around right now to collect your questions. And while we wait for that, for those questions to come in, so when talking about representation, can you talk about how your books have now been made into films, and there are plans for your books? Like, what's next?
There are a lot. There is a series that is going to be done, and I think that one of the person who is working on it with me, Lindsay Williams, is here tonight, is there. So this fantastic guy is going to work on the series adapted from The End of Eddie. I also have plans with a couple of people. I don't know what I am, what I can say or not. Mm-hmm. But in a way, what I can say more generally about that thing is that For me, it's such a relief, you know. For me, it's such a relief when my story doesn't belong to me anymore. When someone is talking on my behalf, when someone is talking for me at my place, I think it can be such a liberating thing. And it's one of the issues that I'm raising in History of Violence. When after the assault, I report and I talk. And at some point, I'm tired, but not tired the way we usually use it. There is something on my body. I don't want to talk about it anymore, and I wanted someone else to talk at my place for me, you know. And I know that sometimes in the U.S. it's considered a bad thing to talk about on behalf of someone, but for me it is not. For me, it depends if you talk and the person is okay, or if you take the voice from the person. But I also think that it's beautiful to not to carry a pain that you didn't choose, you know? I think it should be a fundamental right for people to not carry a pain that they did not choose. I had a conversation recently with a friend about Light in August, the novel of William Faulkner, which is one of my favorite novels, so I buy it for all my friends. Mm-hmm. And in this book, so I don't know if you know it, there is a guy called Joe Christmas, who is suspected by other people, we don't really know, he's suspected of being black, having black blood. So he looks white, but he has, according to people, black blood. And because of that, he has to go through a lot of suffering and a lot of problems and a lot of difficulties. And so at some point, he doesn't want to say it anymore. He doesn't want to talk about it anymore. And there was this beautiful scene where he's in the black neighborhood in a city, and he runs. He wants to run as far as possible. And I offered it to one of my best friends who is black and who is an activist in France. And he told me, I hate Joe Christmas, because if everyone's behaved this way, we will never change anything, you know? And I told him that I understood, but that at the same time, I understood the Joe Christmas. I understood this way of saying, you know, I already suffered of it through my body. Why should I suffer from it again through my language, through what I say, through the statement that I have to do? I would understand if Joe Christmas would say, my struggle is the feminism, and this is my priority, you know? Because as a black person, I suffered enough from racism. I don't want to talk about that, you know? I would understand that if I was doing something like this. I would understand if one day I didn't want to talk about the working class or the poor people anymore, and if I was saying, my struggle is because, you know, I didn't choose to be working class. I didn't choose to be gay. Why should I be the person to talk about it? The question becomes like, is it true what the person is saying? I think people steal your voice when they say something that it's not true. But if they say something that is true, that is relevant to what I am, to my body, to what happened, if it's efficient to undo the social order that was violent to me, it doesn't matter for me if the person is gay or not, if the person is bourgeois or not. The only matter for me is the truth and not the body of the person in front of me. I think so.
I love the sound of it's a... here are the questions.
All right. So thank you for the questions and for your good handwriting, whoever. I appreciate that. So this person is saying, I love your two books, and they thank you for that.
Yes.
And how did you find, decide, and choose your literary style?
I mean, I didn't choose it. I think it wasn't a decision. I had just within my body the traces of the people that I loved, of the writers that I loved. So I didn't really care about it. I was writing and I was trying to build a sentence that would be readable, that would work, that was my only concern. And yes, I don't know. I never think in terms of a style. I think in terms of truth, you know? And a sentence is beautiful because it's something that says something true. That's the way I think. Marguerite Duras, who is one of my heroes, she would always say, I don't know what is style. I don't care about it. And I think I would give the same answer. I really don't care. I think that truth is a rhythm in a way, you know? So if I find the right rhythm about a story, that will be maybe beautiful in the hero of the people that read it, and it will be a beautiful style because it reaches a truth, you know? Yes?
Yeah. And then the marketing of the book is actually something else, because in the U.S., they're both marked as fiction.
Is that marked as novels, right?
As fiction. As novel. Novels.
Yeah, it was the same thing in France, because to me, a novel means a construction, and I don't think that construction means fiction, you know? And I think, on the contrary, to kind of be able to deliver the truth about what happened during my childhood, about what I experienced, what I saw people experienced, I thought that I had to build a literary structure, that it couldn't be just a transcript of my experience like that. And so to say a novel was to make a statement and to say, if you want to say the truth, you have to build it, you know? There is no opposition. And nowadays, there are so many people who are trying to work on it, like Karl Ove Knausgård or Svetlana Alexievich, who build, like, because in the past, most of the time, you had either a novel, literary fiction that was constructed, literary constructed and everything, or you had, like, memoirs that didn't care about writing, that didn't care about structures, that didn't care about rhythm and
ouch,
everything.
Ouch to the memoirists out there. All right. So I... all right. Can you talk about your manifesto and your hopes for the future of literature?
Yes. In a way, like, everything I write is a manifesto, you know? At the beginning of History of Violence, I wanted to write this is my commitment, my modern manifesto. I don't know if you understand. Yes, I also published a manifesto in France, in Le Monde, about the current state of politics, of the political discourses and of the political debate, that was printed in Le Monde and then was published in the Los Angeles Review of Books. I wrote with Geoffroy de Laganerie, who is one of the most talented philosophers in the world, and I don't exaggerate, and who is also my best friend. really, it's two completely different things. It was during the campaign in France, or right after Hollande was elected, and we were really scared to see that the far right was more and more and more important in the mediatic world, in the media, in the newspapers, on TV and everything. And we were really scared to see that as soon as Marine Le Pen or the current president of the United States or people like them would say something stupid, it would become immediately the cover of the New York Times or the cover of the New York of the New Yorker and the cover of Le Monde. So in this manifesto with Geoffroy de Laganerie, we were struggling for the uses of silence as a weapon. You know, we thought like there are so many people who do art, who write books, who do performances, who make movies about the world of today, against racism, against dominations, against violence. And we don't see them on the cover of the New York Times because we see the stupid things that these people say all the time, again and again and again. And like liberal people say, oh, because we have to prove that they are wrong. But frankly, all the people who read the New York Times know that these people are wrong. That's precisely why they are reading the New York Times, because they know that these people are wrong, and so that's why they want to read it. And so it depends, of course, on the issues. There are issues that needed to be addressed. But during the campaign in the U.S., I was in the United States. I was the United States in the U.S. the day that that guy won, and frankly, during the whole campaign, he was like everywhere. As soon as he would say the most stupid things, it became a debate. And so, what we wanted to do with Geoffroy de Laganerie is to challenge the idea of debate, and not to just to do you take two opinions and it becomes a debate, but to say what is a debate and what deserves to be a debate. And for us and for me, there are some questions that are not questions. They are insult, you know. You don't do a debate on should a woman and men have the same rights. This is an insult to ask this question. It should be obvious and it should be done immediately. François Hollande was homophobic in France, where he said that we needed a debate about gay marriage, okay? Because straight people had it and others didn't have it. So just to ask and to raise the question was already an insult. And so like the medias were always raising this debate and try to answer these debates, but just to raise the debate was already absurd. And so yes, this manifesto is about, it's a manifesto about fight and silence.
And in April of this year, you stated that the political situation has been so distracting that you've had a hard time focusing on writing.
Yes.
Is that still the case, or have you found
no, it's
a way
true.
To shut it out?
And I think it's a collective phenomenon, because a lot of my friends are writers, including from the United States. And it was the current situation is very distracting. It's really... You sometimes feel powerless, you know. You sometimes feel, and it's really important to also, I think, to talk about this powerlessness. It's a feeling that we have so much, so many of us sometimes. We have the impression that we fight again and again and again, and it's so hard to change anything, you know. And so the thing is, maybe we are powerless because we don't use the right tools enough, you know. And for example, the silence can be a good tool from time to time. And we have to reinvent the way of protesting, you know. It's true that, for example, demonstrating, I do it all the time. I demonstrate a lot. And not because I am French, but because I am lefty. And I am crazy against what is going on around the world. But we see that very often it doesn't change a lot, you know. We go, we demonstrate, we see the people that we expect to see. Mm-hmm. We have a good moment, And when we go back home and the government don't care and everything. And so I still do it and I still think it's important to do it, but it's really important to reinvent ways of doing it, you know. There are people who do it, for example, through Anonima, like Chelsea Manning did, or through different, you know, kinds of things that would be efficient. That would be our question, how to be efficient, how to change something, how to have an impact on people's body, you know. That should be our goal.
Does writing feel like an efficient way?
I try to find ways to be as efficient as possible. I talked a lot about how would it be possible to go from engaged literature, committed literature, as Sartre put it, Jean-Paul Sartre, to confrontational literature, you know, that a literature that would be unbearable for the dominant, something that would, for the ruling classes and everything, something that would find tools, even in a way like stylistic tools, to be unbearable to the dominant and to really affect them. It's what I try to do. That's why also the books are very forward. That's why they are dealing with violence a lot, you know, because also I think the more we talk about violence and the more we create beauty and happiness in our world, like the anti-racist movement, the feminist movement, the LGBT movement. There were movements that talked about violence, you know, or even the Marxist movement in a way. They say that as a gay woman, as a working class person, your life is made with violence and you have to change it. And so I talk about violence a lot because I am optimistic, because I think that things can change. And so I really, when I write, I really think about that. I really think, how could I be efficient? And when there is something very practical that happened, there is something that I say all the time when I give a lecture, because it's the most beautiful thing that happened in my life, which was that after The End of Eddie was published in Spain, Acabar con Eddie Belgel, there was a foundation that was created in Madrid called Fundación Eddie. And it's a foundation that provides free apartments for LGBT people who have been chased from their family, or LGBT people who escaped their country but don't have papers, so they give them apartments illegally for them to stay. And for me, that was the most beautiful thing that happened, you know, because I thought, like, my book have an effect on these people, even if they didn't read it. You know, I went to the foundation, they didn't read it, and I just didn't care, you know, because I was so happy to see that a book could have an effect on someone's body, you know. I saw these bodies, I thought, like, wow. So that's really what I'm looking for when I write. I don't care about other stuff. I don't care about culture. I don't care about pleasing the readers. I don't care about the bourgeoisie. I just care about how can I make the life of people who suffered a little bit more bearable, you know. That's my only question.
One question, and it's a quick one, is did you seek therapy, and what kind?
Therapy? Mm-hmm. Do you think I'm crazy? I'm kidding. Therapy is not for crazy people. It was just a French joke. No, I didn't do therapy. Because I had a sociological formation. I studied sociology, and so for me, like two opposite ways of understanding the world, like one eliminates the other, and like Pierre Bourdieu or Michel Foucault were very tough against psychotherapy and everything, and I were on this side, you know, and so. If I was in front of a therapist, I would have thought that I was more clever than the therapist, so it would have not worked, because I would believe what Foucault or Bourdieu said, you know, and because precisely I read Bourdieu, I read Foucault, and it made me understand so many things about my relationship with my father, about my feelings, about my fears, about my shame. And I felt that it saved me, that Beauvoir, that Simone de Beauvoir was enough, that I didn't need more. And of course, I was joking a little bit. I know that psychology and everything is a great field, like with people that invent new things that help people, as we were saying, mm-hmm. in their everyday life. So of course, I was kidding. But it was just not, my trajectory. And how can you understand the relationship with your father or your mother through Oedipus or through this kind of things when you have social class, when you have gender, when you have race, when you have history and sociology? It didn't work for me.
Mm. That's true. And so this will be our last question of the evening, and since it has...
because it's half in French and half in English. So the question is, would you have crossed the social borders if you were not gay? And I think not. I think that being gay is really what saved me, in a way, saved my life. It was a very big statement that I made in The End of Eddie, in my first book. What I said is that I was not born different, you know. There are so many stories of outsiders, and to start with Le Rouge et le Noir from Stendhal, The Red and the Black from Stendhal, so many stories of outsiders that depict the outsider as someone who was more clever or more sensible to arts or to literature or to theater or to something than the others in his family. And for me, it would have been impossible to do that. It would have been so arrogant and so violent and so not true to say I was more clever than my mother. I was not more clever than my mother. I was not more free than my sister. But just the thing is that I had two social determinism. I had the social class determinism, poor, and at the same time, I had the sexual determinism, gay. And it was because I was over-determined that I escaped. Not because I escaped determinism, but because I had more determinism. Mm-hmm. I was more determined by the world and by society than other people. And it's because of that that I escaped. So it means that people made me different, you know? Because when I was a child, they were telling me, you are different, you are different, you are different. And I didn't want to be different. And The End of Eddie, the story of the book, is a story of the struggle of a child, of the child I used to be, that fight in order to be normal, to what the other call normal, in order to be conform, in order to be masculine. It was my biggest dream to fit in. I didn't want to be different. But people were telling me again, you are different, you are different, you are different. So at some point in my life, I had no choice, and I had to become different. And so when I wrote it in The End of Eddie, I really wanted to challenge people, you know, because if I was saying that Eddie became different, it raises the question, like, what do you do and how do you do to make people different, you know? Because if I was saying I was more clever or sensible than my mother, then you just wait for clever and sensible people to rise and to escape. My question was much more political. I wanted people to feel that question. What do I do, or why? What don't I do in order to help people to become different? Once does isn't born different, once become different. And that was a statement of the book. So it was because I was gay, but it could have been for something else. And so it means that we can build ways for people to be different and to become what they want to become.
Mm-hmm. Right. What a wonderful note to end on. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Aloud is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.